Chapter 2. Going to the Falcon's Nest. It was more than a year later, in the hot and spacious days after the long dance, that a messenger came down the road from the north to Middle Valley, asking for the widow Goha. People in the village put him on the path, and he came to Oak Farm late in the afternoon. He was a sharp-faced, quick-eyed man. He looked at Goha and at the sheep in the fold beyond her, and said, "Fine lambs. The mage of Re Albi sends for you."
"He sent you?"
Goha inquired, disbelieving and amused. Ogion, when he wanted her, had quicker and finer messengers, an eagle calling, or only his own voice saying her name quietly, "Will you come?" The man nodded.
"He's sick," he said. "Will you be selling off any of the ewe lambs?"
"I might. You can talk to the shepherd if you like. Over by the fence there. Do you want supper? You can stay the night here if you want, but I'll be on my way."
"Tonight?"
This time there was no amusement in her look of mild scorn.
"I won't be waiting around," she said.
She spoke for a minute with the old shepherd, Clearbrook, and then turned away, going up to the house built into the hillside by the oak grove. The messenger followed her. In the stone-floored kitchen, a child, whom he looked at once and quickly looked away from, served him milk, bread, cheese, and green onions, and then went off, never saying a word. She reappeared beside the woman, both shod for travel and carrying light leather packs. The messenger followed them out, and the widow locked the farmhouse door. They all set off together, he on his business, for the message from Ogion had been a mere favour added to the serious matter of buying a breeding ram for the Lord of Re Albi, and the woman and the burned child bade him farewell, where the lane turned off to the village. They went on up the road he had come down, northward, and then west into the foothills of Gaunt Mountain. They walked until the long summer twilight began to darken. They left the narrow road then, and made camp in a dell down by a stream that ran quick and quiet, reflecting the pale evening sky between thickets of scrub willow. Goha made a bed of dry grass and willow leaves, hidden among the thickets like a hare's form, and rolled the child up in a blanket on it.
"Now," she said, "you're a cocoon. In the morning you'll be a butterfly and hatch out."
She lighted no fire, but lay in her cloak beside the child, and watched the stars shine one by one, and listened to what the stream said quietly, until she slept. When they woke in the cold before dawn, she made a small fire and heated a pan of water to make oatmeal gruel for the child and herself. The little ruined butterfly came shivering from her cocoon, and Goha cooled the pan in the dewy grass so that the child could hold it and drink from it. The east was brightening above the high, dark shoulder of the mountain when they set off again. They walked all day at the pace of a child who tires easily. The woman's heart yearned to make haste, but she walked slowly. She was not able to carry the child any long distance, and so to make the way easier for her, she told her stories.
"We're going to see a man, an old man called Ogion,"
she told her as they trudged along the narrow road that wound upward through the forests.
"He's a wise man, and a wizard. Do you know what a wizard is, Teru?"
If the child had had a name, she did not know it, or would not say it. Goha called her Teru. She shook her head.
"Well, neither do I," said the woman. "But I know what they can do. When I was young, older than you, but young, Ogion was my father, the way I'm your mother now. He looked after me and tried to teach me what I needed to know. He stayed with me when he'd rather have been wandering by himself. He liked to walk all along these roads, like we're doing now, and in the forests and in the wild places. He went everywhere on the mountain, looking at things, listening. He always listened, so they called him the Silent. But he used to talk to me. He told me stories, not only the great stories everybody learns, the heroes and the kings and the things that happened long ago and far away, but stories only he knew.
She walked on away before she went on.
I'll tell you one of those stories now. One of the things wizards can do is turn into something else. Take another form. Shape-changing, they call it. An ordinary sorcerer can make himself look like somebody else, or like an animal, just so you don't know for a minute what you're seeing, as if he'd put on a mask. But the wizards and mages can do more than that. They can be the mask. They can truly change into another being. So a wizard, if he wanted to cross the sea and had no boat, might turn himself into a gull and fly across. But he has to be careful. If he stays a bird, he begins to think what a bird thinks and forgets what a man thinks, and he might fly off and be a gull and never be a man again. So they say there was a wizard once, a great wizard, who liked to turn himself into a bear, and did it too often, and became a bear, and killed his own little son. And they had to hunt him down and kill him. But Ogion used to joke about it too. Once when the mice got into the pantry and ruined the cheese, he caught one with a tiny mousetrap spell, and he held the mouse up like this, and looked at it in the eye, and said, "I told you not to play mouse." And for a minute I thought he meant it. Well, this story is about something like shape-changing, but Ogion said it was beyond all shape-changing he knew, because it was about being two things, two beings at once, and in the same form. And he said that this is beyond the power of wizards. But he met with it in a little village around on the northwest coast of Gaunt, a place called Camay. There was a woman there, an old fisherwoman, not a witch, not learned, but she made songs. That's how Ogion came to hear of her. He was wandering there the way he did, going along the coast, listening, and he heard somebody singing, mending a net or caulking a boat and singing as they worked. "Farther west than west, beyond the land, my people are dancing on the other wind." It was the tune and the words both that Ogion heard, and he had never heard them before. So he asked where the song came from, and from one answer to another he went along to where somebody said, "Oh, that's one of the songs of the woman of Camay." So he went along to Camay, the little fishing port where the woman lived, and he found her house down by the harbour, and he knocked on the door with his major's staff, and she came and opened the door. Now, you know, you remember when we talked about names, how children have child names, and everybody has a use name, and maybe a nickname too. Different people may call you differently. You're my Teru, but maybe you'll have a Hardik use name when you get older. But also, when you come into your womanhood, you will, if all be rightly done, be given your true name. It will be given you by one of true power, a wizard or a mage, because that is their power, their art, naming. And that's the name you'll maybe never tell another person, because your own self is in your true name. It is your strength, your power. But to another it is risk and burden, only to be given in utmost need and trust. But a great mage, knowing all names, may know it without your telling him. So Ogion, who is a great mage, stood at the door of the little house there by the sea wall, and the old woman opened the door. Then Ogion stepped back, and he held up his oak staff and put up his hand, too, like this, as if trying to protect himself from the heat of a fire. And in his amazement and fear, he said her true name aloud, "Dragon." In that first moment, he told me, it was no woman he saw at all in the doorway, but a blaze and glory of fire, and a glitter of gold scales and talons, and the great eyes of a dragon. They say you must not look into a dragon's eyes. Then that was gone, and he saw no dragon, but an old woman standing there in the doorway, a bit stooped, a tall old fisherwoman with big hands. She looked at him as he did at her, and she said, "Come in, Lord Ogion." So he went in. She served him fish soup, and they ate, and then they talked by her fire. He thought that she must be a shape-changer, but he didn't know, you see, whether she was a woman who could change herself into a dragon, or a dragon who could change itself into a woman. So he asked her at last, "Are you a woman or dragon?" And she didn't say. But she said, "I'll sing you a story I know." Teru had a little stone in her shoe. They stopped to get that out and went on, very slowly, for the road was climbing steeply between cut banks of stone overhung by thickets where the cicadas sang in the summer heat. So this is the story she sang to him, to Ogion. When Segoy raised the islands of the world from the sea in the beginning of time, the dragons were the firstborn of the land and the wind blowing over the land. So the song of the creation tells, but her song also told that in the beginning dragon and human were all one. They were all one people, one race, winged and speaking the true language. They were beautiful and strong and wise and free. But in time, nothing can be without becoming. So among the dragon people, some became more and more in love with flight and wildness, and would have less and less to do with the works of making, or with study and learning, or with houses and cities. They wanted only to fly farther and farther, hunting and eating their kill, ignorant and uncaring, seeking more freedom and more. Others of the dragon people came to care little for flight, but gathered up treasure, wealth, things made, things learned. They built houses, strongholds to keep their treasures in, so they could pass all their gain to their children, ever seeking more increase and more. And they came to fear the wild ones, who might come flying and destroy all their dear hoard, burn it up in a blast of flame out of mere carelessness and ferocity. The wild ones feared nothing. They learned nothing. Because they were ignorant and fearless, they could not save themselves when the flightless ones trapped them as animals and killed them. But other wild ones would come flying and set the beautiful houses afire and destroy and kill. Those that were strongest, wild or wise, were those who killed each other first. Those who were most afraid, they hid from the fighting, and when there was no more hiding, they ran from it. They used their skills of making, and made boats and sailed east, away from the western isles where the great winged ones made war among the ruined towers. So those who had been both dragon and human changed, becoming two peoples, the dragons, always fewer and wilder, scattered by their endless, mindless greed and anger in the far islands of the western reach, and the human folk, always more numerous in their rich towns and cities, filling up the inner isles and all the south and east. But among them, there were some who saved the learning of the dragons, the true language of the making, and these are now the wizards. But also, the song said, there are those among us who know they were once dragons, and among the dragons there are some who know their kinship with us. And these say that when the one people were becoming two, some of them, still both human and dragon, still winged, went not east but west, on over the open sea, till they came to the other side of the world. There they live in peace, great winged beings both wild and wise, with human mind and dragon heart. And so she sang, farther west than west, beyond the land, my people are dancing on the other wind. So that was the story told in the song of the woman of Kamei, and it ended with those words. Then Ogion said to her, when I first saw you, I saw your true being. This woman who sits across the hearth from me is no more than the dress she wears. But she shook her head and laughed, and all she would say was, if only it were that simple. So then, after a while, Ogion came back to Re Albi. And when he told me the story, he said to me, ever since that day, I have wondered if anyone, man or dragon, has been farther west than west. and who we are, and where our wholeness lies. Are you getting hungry, Teru? There's a good sitting place, it looks like, up there where the road turns. Maybe from there we'll be able to see Gaunt Port, away down at the foot of the mountain. It's a big city, even bigger than Valmath. We'll sit down when we get to the turn, and rest a bit.
From the high corner of the road, they could indeed look down the vast slopes of forest and rocky meadow to the town on its bay, and see the crags that guarded the entrance to the bay, and the boats on the dark water like woodchips or water beetles. Far ahead on their road, and still somewhat above it, a cliff jutted out from the mountainside, the Overfell, on which was the village of Rhea Albi, the Falcon's Nest. Teru made no complaints, but when presently Goha said, "Well, shall we go on?" The child, sitting there between the road and the gulfs of sky and sea, shook her head. The sun was warm, and they had walked a long way since their breakfast in the dell. Goha brought out their water bottle, and they drank again. Then she brought out a bag of raisins and walnuts, and gave it to the child.
"We're in sight of where we're going," she said, "and I'd like to be there before dark, if we can. I'm anxious to see Ogyen. You'll be very tired, but we won't walk fast, and we'll be there safe and warm tonight. Keep the bag, tuck it in your belt. Raisins make your legs strong. Would you like a staff, like a wizard, to help you walk?"
Teru munched and nodded. Goha took out her knife and cut a strong shoot of hazel for the child, and then seeing an alder fallen above the road, broke off a branch of it and trimmed it to make herself a stout, light stick. They set off again, and the child trudged along, beguiled by raisins. Goha sang to amuse them both, love songs and shepherd songs and ballads she had learned in the Middle Valley. But all at once her voice hushed in the middle of a tune. She stopped, putting out her hand in a warning gesture. The four men ahead of them on the road had seen her. There was no use trying to hide in the woods till they went on or went by.
"Travelers,"
she said quietly to Teru, and walked on. She took a good grip on her alder stick. What Lark had said about gangs and thieves was not just the complaint each generation makes that things aren't what they used to be and the world's going to the dogs. In the last several years, there had been a loss of peace and trust in the towns and countrysides of Gaunt. Young men behaved like strangers among their own people, abusing hospitality, stealing, selling what they stole. Beggary was common where it had been rare, and the unsatisfied beggar threatened violence. Women did not like to go alone in the streets and roads, nor did they like that loss of freedom. Some of the young women ran off to join gangs of thieves and poachers. Often they came home within a year, sullen, bruised, and pregnant. And among village sorcerers and witches, there was rumour of matters of their profession going amiss. Charms that had always cured did not cure. Spells of finding found nothing, or the wrong thing. Love potions drove men into frenzies not of desire, but of murderous jealousy. And worse than this, they said, people who knew nothing of the art of magic, the laws and limits of it, and the dangers of breaking them, were calling themselves people of power, promising wonders of wealth and health to their followers, promising even immortality. Ivy, the witch of Goha's village, had spoken darkly of this weakening of magic, and so had Beech, the sorcerer of Valmath. He was a shrewd and modest man who had come to help Ivy do what little could be done to lessen the pain and scarring of Teru's burns. He had said to Goha,
"I think a time in which such things as this occur must be a time of ruining, the end of an age. How many hundred years since there was a king in Havna? It can't go on so. We must turn to the center again or be lost. Island against island, man against man, father against child."
He had glanced at her, somewhat timidly, yet with his clear, shrewd look.
"The ring of Erith Akbi is restored to the tower in Havna," he said. "I know who brought it there. That was the sign, surely, that was the sign of the new age to come. But we haven't acted on it.
We have no king. We have no center. We must find our heart, our strength. Maybe the archmage will act at last."
And he added with confidence, "After all, he is from Gaunt." But no word of any deed of the archmage, or any heir to the throne in Havner, had come, and things went badly on. So it was with fear and a grim anger that Gohar saw the four men on the road, before her, step two to each side, so that she and the child would have to pass between them. As they went walking steadily forward, Teru kept very close beside her, holding her head bent down, but she did not take her hand. One of the men, a big-chested fellow with coarse black hairs on his upper lip, drooping over his mouth, began to speak, grinning a little. "Hey there," he said. But Gohar spoke at the same time, and louder.
"Out of my way,"
she said, raising her alder stick as if it were a wizard's staff.
"I have business with Ogion."
She strode between the men, and straight on, Teru trotting beside her. The men, mistaking effrontery for witchery, stood still. Ogion's name, perhaps, still held power. Or perhaps there was a power in Gohar, or in the child. For when the two had gone by, one of the men said,
"Did you see that?"
and spat, and made the sign to avert evil.
"Witch and a monster brat," another said. "Let him go."
Another, a man in a leather cap and jerkin, stood staring for a moment while the others slouched on their way. His face looked sick and stricken, yet he seemed to be turning to follow the woman and child, when the hairy-lipped man called to him,
"Come on, Handy!"
And he obeyed. Out of sight around the turn of the road, Gohar had picked up Teru and hurried on with her until she had to set her down and stand gasping. The child asked no questions and made no delays. As soon as Gohar could go on again, the child walked as fast as she could beside her, holding her hand.
"You're red," she said, "like fire."
She spoke seldom, and not clearly, her voice being very hoarse, but Gohar could understand her.
"I'm angry," Gohar said with a kind of laugh. "When I'm angry, I turn red. Like you people, you red people, you barbarians of the western lands. Look, there's a town there, Head. That'll be Oak Springs. It's the only village on this road. We'll stop there and rest a little. Maybe we can get some milk. And then, if we can go on, if you think you can walk on up to the falcon's nest, we'll be there by nightfall, I hope."
The child nodded. She opened her bag of raisins and walnuts and ate a few. They trudged on. The sun had long set when they came through the village and to Ogion's house on the clifftop. The first stars glimmered above a dark mass of clouds in the west over the high horizon of the sea. The sea wind blew, blowing short grasses. A goat bleated in the pastures behind the low, small house. The one window shone dim yellow. Gohar stood her stick and Teru's against the wall by the door and held the child's hand and knocked once. There was no answer. She pushed the door open. The fire on the hearth was out, cinders and grey ashes, but an oil lamp on the table made a tiny seed of light, and from his mattress on the floor in the far corner of the room, Ogion said,
"Come in, Tenar."